strangle their kids.
You're going to stay at the apartment.
Hey. The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Thursday, April 5th, 2012, and I'm sorry about the delay. We were waiting to establish a quorum. And we are going to have first up on our agenda this morning, House File 1850, Senator Ortman. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. House File 1850 is a very straightforward bill. It creates an incentive for all state government employees to help us find savings in the budget. And when they do find savings, they will be rewarded with a portion of that savings up to $50,000. And we want to provide every employee in the state an opportunity to earn that by going back and identifying savings either individually or as a team. And members, I hope that you'll move along House File 1850 to get strong support in the State Government Committee.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Are there any questions? Senator Ortman, when did this go into effect, this program?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I don't know. It was in effect. Previously, there was a $1,000 per individual and a $2,500 per team bonus limit, but what we're doing is changing the caps. I don't know when it was first instated into law. Sorry, Madam Chair.
So someone could earn up to $50,000, which means that they would have had to have saved $500,000. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's up to 10% of, with a cap of $50,000.
Okay. Have any rewards been claimed in the past under the current law?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, so
Senator Magnus,
do we have an effective date here, Senator Ortman, when are you planning on this taking effect?
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, along with any other changes in law.
Okay.
So it would be August 1st if there's no stated date.
Yep. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience here to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Perry?
I would move House File 1850 be recommended to pass.
Senator Perry moves that House File 1850 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. We could probably even put it on the consent calendar. Would you like that?
Madam Chair, I would appreciate that.
If there's not going to be any amendments, it's not controversial. So we'll place it on the consent calendar. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on the consent calendar. Thank you, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and members, thank you.
Our next bill will be Senate File. We're going to take Senator Peterson next because we need to have some space for your testifiers to come in and sit down, so we thought if we took this one first, it would help. Senate File 1199. Good morning, Senator Peterson.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you may recall, this bill was before you last year, and you had passed it and sent it to general orders, and so you may question the amendment because the amendment significantly changes the bill. Chair and members, I need to offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Perry will offer the A2 amendment. It is being distributed.
Members, you may recall from last year that this bill addressed a number of different areas within the prevailing wage bill. The most largest section, and I would say probably the most controversial, was the way that wage is calculated. You may recall the mode method, which is used now, which is the most often reported wage in the survey. And we had proposed to change that to the mean method, which would have been the average wage reported in the method in the survey process, in an effort to try and show folks and others in the legislature and in this building that we're trying to make a compromise and move forward. Basically, this amendment is a delete everything amendment that takes out that entire section, the way the wage is calculated, and just asks for a 40-hour work week, basically, so So within the law, it would be overtime would be paid at 40 hours for the week, Monday through Saturday, with Sundays not being included. And then rather than what it is currently now, where overtime is paid after an eight-hour day on the job. The second section you'll see relates specifically, currently right now, the project minimum for when prevailing wage kicks in, which is, you know, prevailing wage law kicks in when a project is funded by state dollars, state taxpayer dollars. That's the only time generally that prevailing wage kicks in. And so right now, the project minimum, if a project is $25,000 or more, then the prevailing wage would kick in. And the best example, and what I want to change that to, is $500,000 for a project minimum, and then have an automatic inflator so that this $25,000 number goes all the way back to 1973 when the law was put into effect, essentially. And so the best example I can share relating to that specifically issue, before I came to this building, I was serving in the city of St. Cloud on the city council and on the HRA board. And the year before I came down here, we had a painting contract that came through. We had to repaint a number of the buildings. The HRA in St. Cloud's actually one of the largest landlords in the city with over 1,000 units. And we had to paint some rooms. And so the bid came back at about $100,000. And so then the question was asked, well, did we use the prevailing wage rate? And the answer was no. And so then the next month, the same contract came back with an increase, which isn't important. But what the important part is that when we have smaller projects within the state system, whether it be a housing and redevelopment authority, whether it be your local college campus, you know, MinSCU or community college, when there's state dollars involved, I'm not sure that that's the best way to handle that. We, you know, I believe that that project minimum should be a little higher so that those folks can just bring people in and get that work done on smaller projects and not be concerned about whether it needs to be a prevailing wage job at all. So that's why we'd propose to raise the project minimum. So those are the two features of the amendment. And as I mentioned, I hope you can recognize it's a significant change and compromise to what we had before you last year. Even though you supported and voted that bill out as it was last year, I would ask you to consider this change in an effort to show the residents of Minnesota that this is a significant compromise, and ask you to pass this bill out again today.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. And the change on the hours of labor, you're going from 8 to 10 hours per day, but you're staying with the 40 hours per week for overtime. So this would allow people to work like 4 10-hour days instead of 5 8-hour days?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That's a popular thing here in the Senate when we have flex time in the summer. I know that a lot of our employees like that option. Are there questions? Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the change, Senator Peterson, so with the changes you've made in your amendment here, now taking out the meat and the mode provisions, and so what effect does this have on the fiscal note? Looks like you probably may not have hardly any cost on your bill now.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair and Senator Magnus, I think your assumption is accurate. Last year we had about an $88,000 fiscal note, if I recall correctly, yeah. And that was primarily from the Department of Labor for changes in software for the wage calculation issue that we talked about. I did talk briefly with the Department of Labor about this issue this morning, Madam Chair, and I think they are willing to come and talk about the fiscal note if you would like them to do that.
Mr. Rutowski.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm John Rutowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. As you all know, we've just looked at this new amendment. Testify that because you're eliminating the rate of or the method of calculation that certainly eliminates last year's fiscal note 100%. Adjustment for the rate of inflation, there might be a minor cost to the department. There would be a minor cost. I just don't know what it is, Madam Chair.
A good fiscal analyst would be able to figure that out fairly quickly, I'm sure.
Madam Chair, I'm not a fiscal analyst.
Well, someone in your department
yes.
might be.
Thank you.
Is there anyone here who would like to testify for or against the bill?
Good morning, Madam Chairman, or Chairwoman, sorry, Madam Chairwoman and Senators. My name is Phil Raines from Associated Builders and Contractors. I just want to testify in favor of this amendment. Associated Builders and Contractors is very interested in the prevailing wage law. We've been looking for some major changes in this law and would still like to see some significant changes in it. We are looking for a compromise, something that everybody can support. Senator Peterson has been in negotiations with various parties on this bill. I'm not sure that everyone's on board with this. Actually, I'm sure that everybody is not on board with it. But we looked into specifically the project minimums. A couple of years back, the city of Mankato was looking at doing prevailing wage. They looked at the costs involved and found that there was a minimum administrative cost of $5,000 per contract for administering prevailing wage attached to a job. When you have a project minimum of $25,000 that hasn't been changed since 1973, you can imagine $5,000 on a $25,000 project is a whole lot of administrative burden for a very small contract. Construction costs have inflated dramatically since 1973. And I know in the past, this legislature or previous legislatures looked at the issue of contracting, whether they were required to put it out for bid. There's actually been a change in that, moving those numbers up to $50,000 and $100,000 on various contracts where there's no bid even required by the state. So these are very, very small contracts for construction at $25,000 now. I would like to see that increase. $500,000 is not going to get many projects at all. You know, if you do anything in construction anymore, it seems like it goes over $100,000 in commercial work. This won't even include a re-roof of something. It might include fixing a small portion of a roof would come under $500,000. And that's about the biggest job I can see that would come under this. Like I said, when you have a $5,000 administrative cost on the front end, as a minimum for administering the project, this makes a lot of sense to up those minimums. Also, like you said before, 410s is something that's become an industry practice. Some people do it. Some people don't do it. It is included in many labor contracts right now on private work. We're just asking for a similar thing to be on public work.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out why the huge jump from 25,000 to $500,000. That's significant.
Mr. Raines?
That increase is based on the cost of construction that's come as that. We looked at this trying to find an appropriate inflator, inflation index that would go with this. And there is now, since 2004, what's included in there, the PPI index for construction. It runs significantly above regular inflation, regular CPI. So the best thing I could find for it was actually a comparison to GDP. When you look at it as a percentage of GDP, because construction is such a mixed bag of goods that goes into it, it has high technology, it has low technology, it has unskilled labor, it has high skilled labor that goes into it. So the best overall is to look at that percentage of GDP, and that's how we looked at it, and you know, look for a round number that we can go with there.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what kind of research did you do to find this $500,000 mark?
Mr. Raines?
Some of it is coming out of a bag. You have to have a number that goes into it. $500,000 is kind of comparable to previously when they moved up from $5,000 minimum on construction projects not requiring a bid to $50,000 and $100,000 step. This would be a comparable move.
I'll have some more questions later, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify? Mr. Melander?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
I have a question for Mr. Raines. Mr. Raines, there is a difference between prevailing wage in Minnesota and the Davis-Bacon ruling. Can you give the committee a little idea what the difference is? I know it's federal versus state.
Mr. Raines.
Federal versus state, there are a lot of differences. On the overtime hours, there's simply a straight 40-hour-a-week requirement. There's no daily requirement at all. So technically, you could work a 20-hour day under the federal law and not get any overtime. You could do two 20s and not get any overtime. This would simply increase Minnesota's from 8 hours a day to 10 hours a day, allowing a 410. When it comes to the calculation of it, the mode versus mean has been dropped from this legislation. The federal government uses a hybrid. If there's a majority at one rate, that is established as the prevailing wage rate. If there's less than a majority at any one rate, they use an average, just like the bill previously called for. Again, that portion has been dropped from this amendment.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a FYI, if a state project, if a project at one of our tech colleges goes out for bid, and it's $1 million bid, what's the average cost, at least in your mind or your information, cost, excess cost, I should call it, I guess, versus the private sector doing the bidding? What percentage is it higher with prevailing wage? Is that a fair question?
Mr. Raines.
Senator, Chairwoman and Senators, it's hard to make that comparison directly. I'm trying to be completely fair here. State construction is different from regular commercial construction. State tends to have much higher requirements on the materials going in, et cetera. State builds for a long time and tends to build very expansive and elaborate facilities. So it's hard to compare that. We did have a study from the Taxpayers Association, the nonpartisan good government group, that looked at this and said, simply going from a mode to a mean, which would take you closer to open bidding. On private work, you have open bidding, and you have no wage restrictions other than the minimum wage. It saves between 7 and 10% just making that change, getting us back down. I would guess there's no solid numbers on this, but you'd probably have about 4 or 5 more percentage points if you had no restriction on it.
Mr. Melander?
Chair.
Could you just identify yourself?
Oh, yeah, my name is Harry Melander. I'm with the Minnesota Building Trades Council. I asked Senator Peterson if, in fact, I could comment, and he said I could do anything I want. So just a response to Senator Ingebrigtsen, the legislative auditor, I think in 2007 or 2008, did a study, and what they found is that there was if there was any increase with prevailing wages versus the outside, it was not measurable or very, very insignificant. And that was done by the legislative auditor when they reviewed prevailing wages in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Melander. Do you know what the federal threshold is? What the for the Davis-Bacon Act, do you know what the federal threshold is?
Yeah, I believe it's $2,000. Chair?
Yes.
Senator, I believe it's $2,000. Excuse me.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, that's what I have, too, in that 14 states are at or below that number, and 9 states have no threshold at all. So there are 32 states that have prevailing wage laws on the books. In other words, if we go with this language here, we are going to be higher. This threshold is going to be higher than 90% of all the states in the country. So I think that's quite an extravagant jump.
Well, Senator Goodwin, but if 32 states have no prevailing wage laws.
No, that's not what I said. They have prevailing wage laws. 32 states have prevailing wage laws on the books. Of those, only 3 states have thresholds as high as the former one, not this current one. The federal threshold is only $2,000, and 14 states are at or below that number, and 9 states have no threshold at all. So in other words, any project. A prevailing wage applies to any project, no matter what the cost.
Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair, members, I understand people may disagree on the project minimum, but the bottom line, I think most people can understand that it will allow more people to bid projects without having to go through the administrative expense and cost of doing all the prevailing wage reporting. And so I would continue to state that the owners of those projects that are under $500,000, the taxpayers that own these apartment buildings, our technical colleges, our Minsky campuses, U of M, that it will allow more people to bid those and, in theory, bring a more competitive price and get more work done for those additional dollars that are under that threshold.
Mr. Melander, did you have some additional comments?
I do. Thank you, Chair. Chair, Senator Peterson, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to address the committee regarding Senate File 1199. Chair Roebling, my name is Harry Melander, and I'm the chair of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our council represents 50,000 workers throughout the great state of Minnesota, and today we're here to testify in opposition to Senate File 1199. But before I do that, I want to comment on this bill. I'd like to acknowledge Senator Peterson for his work on this issue over the last 12 months with our organization. Senator Peterson, we appreciate your time and willingness to listen to our views. This bill that's being presented, or amendment, is a bit different than last year's version. And although it starts to head towards what we believe happens in the industry, it still misses the mark. Senate File 1199 will give a pay cut to all Minnesotans that currently work on projects where Minnesota prevailing laws exist. It will take the standard 8-hour day and extend it to a 10-hour day, reducing individuals' compensation by nearly 10%. What these modifications mean to Minnesota construction workers. As stated earlier by testifiers, by the testifier, the 10-hour workday is the norm of work in highway and heavy and commercial portion of our industry is somewhat of a half-truth. Although 10 hours and sometimes longer period of hours may be used in the industry, it is not the basis for what we describe as a workday. The workday has always been based off of an 8-hour, 40-hour work week.
Okay.
There's nothing preventing individuals from working for contractors, working longer hours than the hours stated above, but the law states that those individuals will be compensated at time and a half after 8 hours and after 40 during a given work week. Any modification to the 8-hour workday will give Minnesota construction workers a pay cut. We've also heard today that contractors and employees mutually benefit from a 10-hour day, providing longer periods of time, of personal time with their family and friends. I can assure you, Chairwoman and committee members, that the nature of this industry may be one that has concerns for the individuals that work in it, but it's not its primary goal. Although we have a strong industry partnership with our contractors and their professional associations, these companies are entrepreneurial, they're capitalists that create successful business models for themselves and for their shareholders. Chairwoman, we are very supportive of the capitalist appetite that exists in our industry, and we believe that our contractors are profitable, then we too will benefit from that. No contractor will place his or her machine in idle to provide their workers a longer work week. One can only imagine the outrage of Minnesota taxpayers that watch equipment sit idle Thursday through Sunday because their contractors want to provide more quality time for their employees. This will not happen. This does not happen. And any representation that it will is not being truthful regarding how this industry has and will continue to operate. Another section of this bill attempts to raise the bar, a threshold where prevailing wage starts to apply. Currently, those levels are at $2,500 on commercial projects and $25,000 on highway heavy. We believe raising the bar will only discriminate against contractors that may have limited bonding ability, prevent those small IE, MBE contractors, women-owned businesses, and minority businesses from receiving wages that have been certified by our own state. The question I ask, are the skill sets required to do smaller projects any different than those on a larger project? As a former educator in vocational education, the answer is no. We've been working with Senator Peterson over the last year to attempt to make this the needed incremental changes and believe that we were heading in that direction. For the community or party that believes in less government regulation, this modification will set a standard that does not accurately what describes what's happening in the private sector of this industry regarding compensation. We are the private sector. This bill attempts to make artificial changes which are counterproductive for the community that continues to talk about the private sector. Let the private sector drives the economy. Then let the private sector set the standard, not just a few contractors that want to reduce workers' wages. Will contractors be given a reduction in their allowable profits? We discussed this last year. And maybe we should create limits on our employer's ability to profit on state-funded jobs. We would never ask that, would never support that. We believe and support employers. As stated earlier, we want them to succeed. Then why is it so important for this legislature, members of this committee, and thousands of your constituents that would benefit from this statute? Why, oh, why do we want to give them a pay cut? If you asked your constituents, do you want a pay cut? We all know what it would be. They would say no. We believe that our building community, that our building contractors set the standard for the norm of what happens in Minnesota's construction industry. We have set the standard regarding training, job site culture, safety, and compensation before the statute was placed in the law. We are Minnesota's construction industry. Here's a couple of examples. In these down times, we had $14.7 billion of wages from 2005 to 2011, and these are very conservative, realistic numbers. We had 403 million work hours, $72 million of private dollars, not state-funded, private dollars were spent on facility improvements. $118 million was spent on training, private dollars, our dollars. And that we have 4,800 contractors that benefit from these investments. Chair, committee members, we have a strong partnership through Minnesota with the majority of contractors that we call the Minnesota construction industry. We, too, believe that law should accurately reflect what is happening within the industry. This bill does not do this. This bill places regulations that are not the norm for what is happening in the industry. Why is this body trying to create a competitive disadvantage for thousands of Minnesota businesses? Chair, please encourage the industry partners, the private side of our economy, to continue to discuss ways that we can effectively change our industry and continue to work on the work started by Senator Peterson and his leadership last year. Thank you for your time, and I'd be more than happy to try to answer some questions.
Mr. Melander, I'm a little confused. We still have 40 hours.
Correct.
And you're saying that in this industry that oftentimes workers are asked to work 10-hour days now so they get 2 extra hours of overtime every day. But if there's enough work to do that currently for 5 days a week, they are still getting 10 hours of overtime. The overtime would just come on Friday instead of 2 hours every day. So I don't understand how come you think that there would be a pay cut.
Chair, because the law right today, I mean, making the assumption that the 8-hour day, which we believe it is, and I think most people in Minnesota and America, you know, look at when they start work at 8 o'clock, they go home at 4:30. Right now, the law states that when you work in excess of 8 hours, you are compensated at a premium pay or time and a half, which creates an additional hour of compensation for those individuals. My point being, looking at it from an 8-hour day, is that individuals will take a 10% or greater pay cut because of that. But your math, Chair, is correct. That if, in fact, individuals did work past that, our concern is that individuals will use this and not. I mean, there are some good contractors, Chair, that are part of our community. You know, we're not concerned about that. We're concerned about the shenanigans that we see that goes on in this industry, where individuals will start to have shifts from Monday through Thursday, Tuesday through Sunday. You know, we'd like to stay, you know, with our families. In fact, some of us that may have a spiritual side of us might want to attend church on Saturday or Sunday. So this bill just takes that opportunity away from us. So at least now, in its present form, if in fact we are working on those days, at least we're getting compensated for time and a half or a premium pay after the traditional 8-hour day, and especially on Saturdays and Sundays.
Mr. Melander, the bill does say Monday through Saturday, so Sunday is currently still excluded.
Right, and we appreciate that.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I had a question on just that point. So it's becoming more common that great big projects will have a premium added as an incentive to get the work done earlier, and you see workers practically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Working on, like the 35W bridge, for example. So what happens to the wages and the calculation of prevailing wage for all those folks who do work on Sunday when now we decide we have a 6-hour week or 6-day week rather than a 7-day week? What's the effect of that?
Mr. Melander?
Chair, Senator, I believe, this is my belief, so that's kind of my disclaimer, there is no reflection in the amendment that addresses any type of compensation, but I could be wrong.
Mr. Peterson?
So what does that mean?
I think it would have to be addressed in contracts.
Yeah,
but
Madam
Mr.
Chair
Peterson.
And members, that's correct. For example, I would say I think there is highway-heavy contracts right now, for example, that Sundays are double time. So that when they work on Sundays or around the clock, there's contractual agreements that that pay workers more when they are working on the weekends.
And I would echo that. I know with our contractors, many of them offer Saturday at time and a half automatically. Very few of our members actually work on Sunday. I haven't found any that actually did so far in my conversations with our members. There are people that do that, and the ones that do so, I know in several of the union contracts, in several private contracts, they do offer overtime or double time on Sunday if that does get done.
I know that some of the highway crews do it, like we'll shut down a highway for the weekend, and they'll work pretty much through 24 hours sometimes around the clock for 2 days. And then have it reopened again for rush hour on Monday morning. That's something that is appreciated. And so we know then that on Sunday they would be getting double time probably, if that's what their contract called for. Senator Nino, did you have a question?
Chair, might I comment on that, if I could, please?
Mr. Melander.
Chair, Senator, that is true, what some of the comments in regards to compensation, but this bill does not provide that. This bill talks about creating a work schedule that creates that within from Monday through Saturday, individuals can work at night in the daytime, 10 hours a day, without getting compensation. And there is I don't believe, and I could be wrong, within this amendment or the statute that reflects any type of compensation in regards to premium pay for working on Saturday, Sunday, other than outside of the 10-hour or the 40-hour work week. So I just want everyone to be real clear that there is, I do not believe that there is anything in this bill or the statute that talks about compensation on Sunday outside of those parameters of the 40-hour work week or the 10-hour work day.
Mr. Raines.
If I may add a little bit to that. Nothing in the current law allows or requires a premium pay on Saturdays or Sundays. You can see the existing statute that's being modified here simply speaks to the 8-hour work day and the 40-hour work week. There's nothing in the statute right now that requires automatic overtime pay on Saturdays or Sundays. As this amends, it will actually require overtime on Sundays. The way this is written, defining the prevailing hours of labor being from Monday to Saturday. So there is that improvement for workers included in this bill already. Like I said, it's not required by statute already, and this is an improvement over existing statute for workers in that regard. It's also important
Excuse
to look
me. If people want to speak, they can come to the table and identify themselves. And if they don't, we'll ask the sergeants to remove them. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. It's also important to note that this is permissive language. Currently, prevailing wage law does not allow an employer and employee to negotiate to do 4-10s. As we've noted, many workers would prefer to work a 4-10 work week. This would allow it to be done, and it would be allowed to be negotiated for that in union contracts for a premium pay. If the union contracts want to stipulate that it only be an 8-hour work day, they can certainly take the contracts and write that into the contracts as well. 75% of the workforce in Minnesota in construction is non-union, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And this is an acknowledgement of the wide diversity of tactics and procedures that are out there, and allows people to have a more diverse workforce.
Mr. Melander.
Chair, being that it's Holy Week, I just want to make a comment here that we believe, and by the numbers that we provided you, that 75 or 85% of the industry is not done by folks outside of our community. And we'd be more than happy to talk to a committee and show those statistics. And I can tell you that our organizations here, the private side of this, drives this industry and does not reflect those comments that Mr. Range just made.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my questions were answered, but I guess I'll just restate them and make sure I understood correctly. I had two questions. First, a little background. Personally, some of the best hours I worked for Family Friendly were about 10 or 12 years where I was able to work 4-10s. And my understanding, if I'm hearing the testimony correctly, is right now today, if I was working, if this law applied to a job that I was working on, I went to my employer and said, you know, I loved it when I worked 4-10s. Could I do that, please? There is a disincentive for the employer because that would result in, even though I'm working 40 hours, that would result in several hours of time and a half. Even if I didn't want that, I just wanted to have that flexible schedule. So current law would create that disincentive, and this proposal would remove that disincentive. Is that what I understood?
That's
Mr. Raines.
Chairwoman and Senator Nino, that is correct. Under that scenario, the employer would be required to pay 8 hours of overtime to you, 4 hours each day, to do that. It's obviously a disincentive to allow that type of work schedule.
And then second question, Madam Chair.
Senator Nino.
Would the proposal in front of us here, would that preclude in any fashion or prevent job contracts or labor contracts from including a provision requiring the eight-hour day?
Senator? Chair, Senator? I'd like to answer that. I mean, I think that's the one of the greatest challenges we're having here is that this committee, that this legislature is trying to create and become part of the collective bargaining process, and that is not, I don't believe, what we're here for. And in response to your first question, respectfully, is that for any of you that have worked in the construction industry, and I'm not sure, I'm making the assumption that some of you have, especially within the highway industry, I mean, because of where we live, even though it doesn't reflect what's happening today, I mean, we make hay when the sun shines. I mean, our folks work day in, you know, they might work 10, 12, 14 hours a day. What this does is that it doesn't ensure that those employers are going to say, hey, Jim, hey, Jane, okay, we've worked our 40, you can go home now. That's not how this industry works. And we're not concerned about those contractors that are good Minnesotans, you know, good employers and good providers for decent wages in the states. We're worried about the opportunity that this is going to not only create for those contractors that we'll say that are marginal, but more importantly, with the increase in the ceiling, it really starts to eliminate the opportunity for small contractors, for women-owned businesses, you know, for communities that are starting to become a part of this industry. That entry-level opportunity and their compensation would be different than those that work on a project of $500,000 across the street. So it's not only the hours of work, it's also raising the ceiling that I think really is somewhat discriminatory for those emerging businesses, those smaller businesses that are starting to take place and hold, and we're encouraged to be part of our industry.
Madam Chair. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask a question to that point. As I look at this, are we not, and even Senator Peterson, maybe you can answer, are we not opening the door for new emerging businesses to get their foot in the door? Because the way it is now, it appears to me that if you're a giant, if you're one of the construction giants, because you can afford to pay the administrative cost, you're going to get the contract. But myself, as a young emerging businessman that might have a couple of caterpillars and a front-end loader and a maintainer, I really want to get into it. How in the world could I bid that job if I can't afford to pay the administrative cost?
Do you want me to rest? Okay, Chair, Senator. You know, the comment in regards to administrative costs, I think back in the day, probably were much more significant. I mean, all of our payrolls are done electronically. In fact, some of the prevailing wage reporting, and at least they're heading that way, is done electronically. So there isn't a significant amount of what I believe is administrative cost. The other issue we have here today is because of what we're trying to do within the state of Minnesota and create those opportunities. In fact, there was a ruling that just came out last week in regards to our increased efforts that we're going to make in regards to those emerging communities. We're going to have contractors that are giants, as you say, getting paid this way, and smaller contractors, you know, across the street getting paid some arbitrary wage rate that we really are not sure of. So I think this is, you know, the increase of the ceiling even becomes much more complex and problematic in our outreach to the smaller contractors that we need to be part of this industry. So I don't believe that the administrative cost is that large in regards to paperwork that has to be provided on prevailing wage jobs, not in the electronic age.
Well, those who do it should know. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, is there a total, you know, by the ceiling being raised or the level being raised to 500,000, is there some anticipation of these new entrepreneurs, new businesses that would have this opportunity? Are there numbers like that?
No. Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Perry, you know, our industry has been devastated. You know that I manufacture concrete block. I have a small customer list of about 2,000 people. Just in the last 4 years, I just looked at this again last month, I've had over 125 customers file for bankruptcy. That's a bankruptcy notice that comes in the mail across my desk. So I've had over 5% of my customers file for bankruptcy in the last 4 years since this recession has hit. Do I think raising a standard that was established in 1973, just from the pure standpoint of looking at inflation, do I think it's going to allow more people to bid those jobs? Senator Perry, absolutely. Yeah.
Madam Chair.
To this point exactly? Senator Cohen?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson's waiting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have kind of a naive question, but you've been throwing around the the contracts, but it's not clear to me whether you're referring to labor contracts with their employers or the contracts that you have with the person person or entity that's bidding the job. The contract that you sign in order to get that job or work versus the labor contract, and so it was, things were flying by. Are the provisions of these hours and putting in the long hours, are they provisions of the contract within the building company, or are they sometimes driven by the contract that is given for doing the work by the entity providing it, the resources?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the second section when we're talking about the project minimum, that would be the contractor, the contract that the general contractor has with the owner, like the state of Minnesota on a Minsky campus or a community college campus or the U of M. Any project that the contractor would have with that owner, being the state of Minnesota, would need. That's the $500,000 threshold we're talking about in the amendment there. And then the first section is a change in the law, which, you know, I think sometimes can come into play in individual contract negotiations with contractors and their staff. But, yeah, this is a change in the law, you know, so that it allows that 40-hour work week in a 10-hour day rather than an 8-hour day.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Actually, Senator Ingebertson was next.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to follow up on the question that was asked of Mr. Raines before Mr. Melander asked, and it was Senator Nienau's question. So I'd like to have Mr. Raines answer that question. Was directed at him. If we remember it now, I don't remember.
Mr. Raines.
I believe the question, Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, I believe the question was, would this preclude a labor contract requiring an 8-hour work day and requiring overtime after that? And the answer to that question is no. The labor contract can be more restrictive than the state law, but cannot be more liberal, so to speak, than the law. If there are existing labor contracts that require an 8-hour workday 5 days a week, those still stand. There are some people in the industry that feel that a labor contract allowing a 410 trumps the state law and allows them to work that. We have heard reports from people in the field of people doing that contrary to state law, and that is not allowed. That is a violation of the state law, and the state law trumps in that situation.
Thank you.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I apologize because I promised the chair I wouldn't be asking any questions today, but I can't help myself.
Well, I didn't try and make him promise. He just promised.
I volunteered, but Madam Chair, your members are like catnip to me. So So I do have a couple of questions. Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, getting back to Senator Perry's question, during the time I've been here, I've been supportive of building trades issues, but I'm not close to the building trades, so I don't have as much knowledge as other members might have. And certainly, Senator Peterson, you bring a perspective of somebody who works as a manufacturer, but your response to Senator Perry concerned me a little bit, not to diminish what's happened economically either to your company or to many other companies throughout the country, but a general concern I have over these last couple of years with some of the legislation that we've had dealing with labor law and related issues, are we coming up with solutions to what we hope is a more temporary problem, i.e. a very significant recession, and changing laws that have been in place for a number of years, have worked well, don't seem to have created problems, and now we're coming up with a response to what we hope is a more transitory period. And I'm not saying that your answer to Senator Perry was meant to say that, but that's kind of what I inferred a little bit.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, things are getting better. And you can see that by just the tower cranes you see in this city, quite frankly. There's one just southwest of the Capitol. I love to see a tower crane go up, quite frankly. That means something's getting built. But I think relating to this amendment, as you may know, this bill was changed significantly to eliminate all the wage calculation, all those questions related to wages are gone in this amendment now. The second section is simply an effort to get that minimum up to a standard in our current economy, just even through inflation. When we have a project minimum that was set in 1973 of $25,000, we all know we cannot build the same building now for the same price that we did in 1973. And so I think it's fair to ask that project minimum be raised. And then the first section, again, is just relates specifically to a 40-hour work week. And Senator Cohen, I think I just believe that's a standard. I'm 43 years old. You know, I've been working a full-time essentially since I was graduated from high school and through college, doing various things, driving school bus and dump truck and a number of other things. And so is some of this generational? Maybe. I'm not sure. But since I've been working, a 40-hour work week for overtime is reasonable, and it's a standard we see all across the state. And I think both these provisions are fair and reasonable requests to ask the governor to consider. And quite frankly, that's what he's asked me to do on this prevailing wage issue. I did have a chance to meet with him and others on this issue last year, and he's looking for compromise, Senator Cohen, and I'm accommodating that request by taking out a major portion of this bill that people opposed, and that's how we calculate the wage.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, you just said that you can't build the same building for $25,000 that you did in 1973. But the flip side of that is the workers who would be building that building can't buy as much and provide as much for their families. Now, if you're going to be taking 10% or more away from their wages. And, you know, we've all been through this recession. It's been really hard on families. And we've seen people lose their houses. We've seen, you know, people cutting back in all kinds of ways in an attempt to keep their families safe and secure and their life together. But doing this sort of action where you're going to Mr. Raines said, you know, it's a 10% cut. Mr. Melander said it's a 10. Mr. Raines said it was a 10% cut in cost. And where does that come from? It comes right from the workers' pockets. And, you know, we ought to not be in the business of keeping people down. We should be in the business of helping people move forward. And by saying, by statute, we're going to
put in place a mechanism where you get paid less for doing the same work is wrong. And I'm not going to be supporting your bill today. I think it's been a really thoughtful discussion. I think that you've worked really hard on it, Mr. Melander. I know that you said that you'd been working with Senator Peterson on this, but this is the wrong thing to do. And, we just ought not be in the business of harming people in the work that we do here.
Well, Senator Higgins, I know a lot of people think that even having this in statute is the wrong thing to do, that is something that should be decided in contracts only and not put into state law, any of it. So there's both sides of that, and it's all debatable.
Well, that's true, Madam Chair. You know, but we've got Davis Bacon, and we've got Little Davis Bacon, and we've got all kinds of laws and all kinds of labor history in our nation and our state that tell us otherwise. And the protections that we've put in place for workers in this state are important, and are a reason why we have a middle class.
Please. There's no demonstrations in the committee room.
And no. Clear it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Well, that would be scary if there was something called the Perry-Cohen Act, wouldn't it?
I just had to
say that for you, Senator Cohen. But I do have a question. I wanted to clear.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, you just told me yesterday there was something we agreed on. I thought
there
that
is.
Was the Perry-Cohen Act.
Senator Perry.
We're working on that. I do want to clear one thing up because it bothered me ever since Mr. Melander said this. So I need to ask the question. How do you believe that this amendment affects collective bargaining? You made the statement that this will affect collective bargaining, and that bothers me because I don't even know how something like this would even affect that. So, we need to clear the record one way or the other here.
Mr. Melander.
Chair, Senator, absolutely. I think it's, to me, it's very, very clear what's happening here is that this is the first step in changing the way that the majority of companies and construction workers in the state of Minnesota are compensated. I made in my comments talking about a competitive disadvantage. And earlier, I also said that in some parts of our industry, primarily, in the horizontal section, there are flexibilities in regards to hours. But that does not happen widespread. I mean, we're talking about highway, we're talking about heavy, we're talking about, I say this respectfully, I mean, the highway heavy industry is so broad, it's roads and bridges. But then you start to talk about power plants, you talk about work that's done on the river, any heavy industrial building. This example is not what is happening in the private sector, at least within the state of Minnesota. Now, in other places, it may. So what's going to happen is that if, in fact, this law goes into effect, that all of those contractors that presently have the 8-hour workday model will be forced by your action to change the way that they do business much differently than they have for over 100 years because of legislation I don't believe that's government's place. I believe the private sector needs to partner with government. And I mean, that's what I continue to hear. But that will have that effect. Because our contractors will not be able to compete their collective bargaining agreements for those that have, compensation after the typical 8-hour day, that's premium pay. This will have a negative effect on every one of them. And those people are all constituents and contractors and private sector business people in this state. So this law does affect the way that we do business. And it's forcing us to change the way that we do business. And it's not what's happening in the private sector.
Mr. Melander, I keep going back to this, how our staff, for example, really likes the flexibility of having a 10-hour day for 4 days a week. It helps families with child care costs and other things. If both parents have that, then you might only have to have child care for 3 days of the week instead of 5 days. I really question whether your workers wouldn't appreciate some of that flexibility. This is a different time. You know, it isn't. This has been in law for a long time, and I would think that the flexibility would be appreciated, especially by young families.
Madam Chair.
Chair, if I could, you know, absolutely. If, in fact, everyone in this room could work four 10-hour days, there's not a one of them that would say, hey, we wouldn't like it. But the reality of our industry versus the rest of the industry is completely different. I mean, most people go to work and they get sick days. You know, they have their health insurance paid for. That doesn't happen in our industry. Our industry is when we go to, and it really doesn't.
Well, I know they have health benefits.
I mean, no. But we pay for it. What I'm saying, Chair, and I'm sorry, I'm skewing the response, because I mean, our industry is much different than the rest of the world. We're not driving to a corporate office building, checking in, and having flexible. That isn't the nature of our industry. It just isn't. It isn't how it operates. It isn't the nature, and. You know, there are some people that are in certain arenas that have that flexibility to say, yes, we will work Monday through Friday. But that's not our world. I mean, it's not. We are not a place where we go to work. I mean, we're sitting in our trucks eating. I mean, it is still a tough and very, very safe, unsafe industry, much safer than it once was because of some of the laws that you've helped us with. But it is not like driving down to Macy's or going to 3M. It's different. And those of us that have experienced it can tell you time and time again. I mean, if we show up to work 5 minutes early, we're late. I mean, that's just how it is. It's still rough and tumble. It's the, you know, it's a tough business, and it is, and it's improved, and we do a much better job in regards to all of those things that we've talked about. But it is like no other business that I think that any of you have experienced, unless you've worked in it. So my husband, all would like to do that, but it's not going to happen.
Well, my husband did for, I think, 17 years was in the laborers union. So, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of comment on what you commented on, there's nothing now that prevents people from working 10 hours a day or 4 days a week. It's just that they have to be paid overtime for it. Mm-hmm. Nothing in law will prevent people from working 10, 12, 14-hour days if that's what the need is, but they have to be paid overtime. So they could, if they could choose to work four 10-hour days, like Mr. Melander said, that's not how this work operates, but if they could choose that, that would be one thing. Then getting regular pay would be the way to go, but right now they can work 10-hour days. It's just that they have to be paid for their work. There's nothing wrong with that.
Are there any other comments? Senator Stump.
thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I was a few minutes late, but I assume that this went through a policy committee?
It's been last year, Senator Stump. It passed all the committees and was sent to the Senate floor. It's only back here on a Rule 47 because it sat on the floor and didn't get acted upon last session.
And, Madam Chair, the fiscal note is accurate?
No, Senator Stump. The new amendment has no fiscal note with it because we've stripped it down to this delete all amendment, which is what we have to vote on yet. Having a discussion on the delete all amendment this entire time. And maybe we should take that amendment up. I think Senator Perry had offered it earlier, and the discussion has occurred since. Everyone understand the amendment now. We've been talking about it this whole time. So all in favor?
Roll call, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
The clerk will take the roll.
Uh-oh. Senator Bonhoff? Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth? Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nienau?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
Chair Roebling?
Yes.
Thank you.
On a vote of 9-4, the motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I'm still kind of struggling in my mind with this 10 hours and the 40-hour week. Because, you know, to me, I don't understand totally the contractor's behaviors in this.
But I second guess myself.
They would have the power to require that you only work 8-hour days for to get the 40 hours if you wanted to avoid that. This would allow, essentially, if either the employer or the employees would prefer the 10-hour days for the 4-hour to do that and meet the same standard. But none of this prohibits going over 40 hours and having your overtime. It's the combination of the day, the number of days. So it really limits the flexibility that the workers might have in wanting to do the 4-hour day. And how prevalent is it for these contractors to choose that route now if, in fact, it law requires that they pay overtime for part of that 40 hours?
Mr. Raines.
Chair and Senator Olson, I'll try to lay this out.
Talk a little bit more into the mic.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Just move the mic.
Under current law, you may only work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week schedule, without triggering overtime until 40 hours a week. That's current requirement for all contracts, be they non-union, union, etc. You must have that schedule, or if you work a 4-10 schedule, then you must be paid overtime for 8 hours in that week if you only work a 40-hour week. Okay, this law change would allow you to work up to 10 hours a day without getting overtime, up to 40 hours a week without getting overtime. On Sunday and anything over 40 hours in a week, anything over 10 hours in a day, you would be paid overtime. By making this change, this would simply legitimize and allow the practice of working 4-10s, 4 10-hour days. It's what a lot of workers prefer. It's actually what's included in many union labor contracts right now, allowing that 4-10 schedule. There's a big disincentive under the current law to allow people to do a 4-10 schedule. By doing this, this would leave it up to negotiations between employees and employers if they want to be on a 4-10 or on a traditional 8-hour, 5 days a week schedule. It would simply allow that flexibility to do that without having a financial disincentive from the state to go into that schedule. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes, but I'm trying to, Madam Chair and Mr. Raines, psychology here, that the 40-hour week, you know, is the base, and you can arrange it in different ways without entering into overtime. Would you say there are, is there a current practice? Is that very prevalent of avoiding the allowing for the 4-10 because of this? So that you would, in fact, or if people wanted to, I'm just trying to get at whether the concern that this is going to involve pay cuts, especially when we've been discussing the framework of pushing these schedules, and if people are willing to work more, they are going to get the overtime pay. It doesn't necessarily take that away, but it does if you don't have this very arbitrary 8 to 8 hours, 40 hours a week into law.
Yeah.
Mr. Raines.
Chairwoman and Senator Olson, I think you're getting at the point right here, which is
It is an industry practice. It's not uniform. Not everyone out there works a 4-10 schedule. Not everyone out there works a traditional 8-hour, 5 days a week schedule. Like you said, if they go over 40 hours in a week and they're doing overtime and in construction, you do work when they're sun. You will be getting overtime. This won't change that fact in the least. This simply allows the flexible schedule to go to a 4-10s or a 8-5, and takes away that financial disincentive from the state to allow that 4-10 schedule.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Raines, just, and I don't know a lot, but relative to this, but in terms of this 4-day, 10-hour schedule, does it shift, does that, putting this into statute, does that shift, I don't know if upper hand would be the right phrase, to the contractor? And what I'm thinking of is not so much the dollars involved, the loss of overtime, but what about the life safety kinds of issues? And again, I haven't worked construction, but if you're on a job, well, as an example, the light rail construction, I've got a law office that's the western end of University, one of the renovated buildings, so I've watched the light rail, and I show up at my office some morning and it's 10 below thinking I wouldn't work that in a million years. So are there those kinds of issues that if we go to a statutory construction that allows for that 10-hour day that gets in, if we're talking weather problems, if we're talking excessive noise, and now a worker is subject to excessive noise for 10 hours a day as opposed to 8 hours, are there those kinds of considerations that negate what might happen on you know the end of it of you know the cost issues?
Mr. Raines.
Chair Roebling, Senator Cohen. Safety is always a concern on the job. We've certainly been stressing that very highly through our organization. I know the Associated General Contractors have done so as well, entered into actually exclusive agreements with MN OSHA in order to create a safety partnership to try to make our industry a safer industry. And we have a dangerous industry. There's certainly no doubt about that. This is a function of what's going on out there already in the industry. People do, depending on the project is going to determine the hours in a large situation. It is a common industry practice already to work the 4-10s. There is always the safety component that we look at this, and there are certainly reasons with some operators. We do restrict the amount of hours that they can get because after a certain point, you do have a safety concern that comes into play. 4-10s versus 4-8s isn't going to have that much of an effect.
Mr. Melander.
Chair, Senator Cohen, as Mr. Raines indicated, we do have a very, very dangerous industry and have done a much better job in improving that so that we make sure that when people go to work, they come home to their families and friends. Statistically, fatigue happens after 8 hours in the day, and the longer individuals work, the greater their chances are to injure themselves or others, especially when we're working on highway projects and places where the general public is in close proximity. And a comment in regards to that, this is the industry norm. This happens in the industry, but I just want to assure and be somewhat repetitive, it is not the industry norm. It does happen in the industry, but the industry norm is based off of the traditional 8-hour workday.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, we're hoping to come to a vote on this. We have Senator Hans' bill yet.
That could be said of the legislative process, too. When we work long hours, whether it certainly isn't any extra compensation, we may not make as good decisions either that affect people. But.
We've had quite a lengthy discussion on this, and it was a bill that was heard last year.
Madam
and
Chair?
It's only half of it now, and so, or maybe less, significantly less. So, Senator Cohen?
Just a quick comment. I hope Senator Olson wasn't suggesting that we are in physical danger by working on the Senate floor. That hasn't. I thought that might have happened
citizens
to me
are.
Once.
Citizens are.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, there are other kinds of damage that can be done.
Senator Goodwin?
Don't get me started.
One final question. Senator Dobbs has a prevailing wage bill, and that's, as of a couple of weeks ago, been transferred to the Transportation Committee. There's not a lot of difference except that he doesn't change the threshold. So we pretty much have two bills on the same issue, one that's before us today and one that's in transportation. Now, we also have a delete everything amendment today, so which hasn't gone through any other committees in the past. And why isn't this bill going to Transportation Committee, Senator?
Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, my understanding is it's in finance. It was sent back to finance and off of general orders last year, and this is an amendment to Senate File 1199, and my hope is to move it back to general orders today.
Madam that Chair, just intention. One more question on that, Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
This is disturbing to me because this is a big change in policy, and this bill, up until today, I understand, until your delete all amendment, hasn't been heard in any policy committee. Now, we've done this a lot in this committee where amendments have been brought to us that are not your fault. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the way this committee has operated, and that is that they have consistently brought in delete all amendments and changed the bill without it going back to the committee, the policy committee, that can really take a good look at what this policy will do in the areas of transportation, for example, which is, I imagine, a lot of the contracts. So I intend to make the motion to move this back to Transportation Committee once that time comes.
The time is right now, Senator.
Okay,
Goodwin.
Then I'll make the motion to turn this back to Transportation Committee, and I would like a roll call vote, Madam Chair.
Roll call has been requested on Senator Goodwin's motion to refer the bill to the Transportation Committee.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Fischbach?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Higgins?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Senator Langseth? Senator Magnus?
No.
Senator Newman?
No.
Senator Nienau?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Perry?
No.
Senator Stumpf?
Yes.
Chair Roebling?
No. On a motion of 4-9, the motion fails.
Madam Chair, on the bill, I'd like a roll call vote as well.
Okay. Senator Perry will move that Senate File 1199, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on general orders. And a roll call has been requested.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth? Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman? Senator Nienau?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
Chair Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 9-4, the motion does prevail, and the bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks. Thank you, everyone, for coming in.
You bet.
Our next bill on the agenda will be Senator Hahn's bill, Senate File 2093.
Yeah. I think mine was.
We'll wait just a moment while the room clears.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, he makes the decisions.
I think so, because that's a
big one.
Okay.
Work today, huh?
Obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's nice.
They'll be a little more respectful.
It's a call from the governor's office.
Okay, Celia. Did you get a chance to look at that amendment? I sent it to you. I did email it, but I can bring a hard copy to you.
Republicans, people up to the 16th.
I need you to check, make sure before I send it out to everybody.
We had it in our committee. Check real quick.
Yeah, that shows it. I didn't show it. Where's the minimum wage? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I suppose they call
themselves
too.
Huh.
Only back to four.
It was before four. No, he has to do this by memory.
Well, there it is.
Okay.
You heard this on March 29th.
Oh, yeah.
That was last Friday.
Oh. No one's going to be working. I can bring you a hard copy on a Sunday.
Right across the hall. So.
Oh.
Okay.
That's candy.
What? We're still pushing.
They just, yeah.
We got our last bill up here, so we should understand that they won.
They didn't have a good
plan. They yelled at Senator Peterson.
It's Senator Peterson's fault.
We were just yelling at him. Yeah.
We're going to ask for order in the committee room so we can proceed with our agenda. The next bill up is Senator Hand's bill, Senate File 2093. Members, we heard this bill a week ago, and our purpose for bringing it back here is not to review the original bill, but to review an amendment that Senator Hand has for it in light of new developments that occurred this week when the health care plans it became public that there would be a reimbursement to the state of significant funds. And so this is going to be dealing with those funds that will be returned to the state. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And you're right. This was relatively unexpected to return to committee and appreciate members' consideration. And what has happened in the last couple of days, as many, I think, have become aware, is that by contractual arrangements that were implemented, I think, over a year ago, the plans had agreed to restore to the state any monies in excess of 1% over their actual cost of providing the services that they had agreed to do. And so that arrangement resulted in total from the various plans about $73 million. Some of that money, I believe, and I don't know the precise amount, but I believe it's about 60% would also be subject to being returned to the federal government because of the funds. Mr. Albrecht is saying it's 52%.
Excuse me. The conversations need to cease in the back of the room. Go ahead, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Albrecht is correcting me that something over half, 52% of those funds need to be held out, if you will, for possible return to the federal government because federal Medicaid dollars have been involved in the payments to the plans. So the net effect of that is that there is about a almost $28 million influx to the general fund as a result of the return of these monies from the plans. What we have in front of you is an amendment that we're calling a contingent appropriation, and we're calling it contingent because the language of the amendment would recognize that to the extent that these funds do show up as we anticipate them to show up, then we would propose spending the money in the way that the amendment specifies. And members, again, the way I'm thinking about this is these are funds that we have already appropriated and spent, given to the plans to provide health care the people of Minnesota under the contracts with the various plants. So we had made decisions in past years to spend the money, and then as a result of some conditions that, frankly, I think may be, in general, good conditions. We've seen with our state budget, for example, that both in the February and the last November forecast, we saw an improvement in the balance of the state budget that was, frankly, largely due to the fact that the projections of spending, the expectations, the forecast for health care spending were higher than what actually occurred. And so we saw, as a reflection in our state budget, what we call a surplus, but what it really reflects largely is the fact that the anticipated spending didn't occur. And that same condition, I think, carried over into the projections and expectations of what the spending would be needed by the plans to provide the health care under contract, and then given the contractual agreement to return anything over 1% has resulted in this money coming back. So this is money that has been spent in health care, and what I would say is that this is simply a repurposing of monies that had previously been appropriated for health care needs. And so what we've done is we've offered a contingent appropriation bill that would spend just slightly less than $22 million of the $73 million. But as I indicated, more than half of that would be subject to being returned to the federal government. We're also anticipating that a portion of that $27 million that would be returned could be necessary to restore some of the funds. We last year got about a $30 million return from UCARE, I believe, and there's debate going on right now that I believe that some of that will be need to be restored to the federal government, and so we're not anticipating a bill that would spend the entire amount of what might be anticipated coming to the general fund. I do have Mr. Albrecht, our fiscal analyst, here, and I'd like to give him a chance. I think you have a copy of a sort of an abbreviated spreadsheet that outlines the various provisions that we are proposing that this repurposing of healthcare dollars would do. Some of that of the money, most of it, is one-time spending, given that this is a one-time influx of money. There are a couple of provisions that do have tails, and Mr. Albrecht can explain that and why we're doing that. But I'd like to ask him, if he would, to go through the abbreviated spreadsheet that you have in front of you.
Thank you, Senator Hand. Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, you can see on line 7 is the total amount that Senator Hand indicated of $21.868 million in this biennium and tail spending of $10.884 million. This is all within the Department of Human Services. The items that are included in the amendment are on line 92, money. This is a Senator Senjum bill that was heard earlier this year, not funded in our previous bill, for planning money for an autism residential campus. You might care to note that on line 98, there is an amount that will be transferred to the Department of Education for their activities under that bill. On line 100, this is a modification of a governor's budget proposal relating to a provision enacted last year for a 20% rate reduction for relative PCAs, personal care attendants. That provision was subject to a court case that I believe has recently been resolved. The governor proposed to restore the cut on an ongoing basis. This provision restores it, or actually delays the enacting of that cut until 6/30 of 2013. The amount that's reflected here is really only for 6 months at the end of fiscal year 2013. Because the forecast has an assumption in it that the rate reduction would not be able to go into effect until the end of this calendar year, on the assumption that the court case wouldn't have been resolved. Now it has been resolved, but that money is still in the forecast, under the assumption that it would have to be paid until the court case was resolved. This provision ends on June 30th, 2013. There is included in Section 15, which is on page 18 of the amendment, direction to the commissioner to basically take a look at the PCA program within the context of an overall broader directive to look at the whole structure of the MA program and efficiencies within the MA program and so forth, and to report back to the legislature on, you know, if there are ways to modify the program to bring the spending somewhat under control. The tails, if this were to just continue fully funding or fully restoring this reduction, the tails for this item would be over $30 million. On line 109 is another partial governor's recommendation. You may remember that when we brought our bill to the committee last week, there was a provision that restored the emergency medical assistance coverage for dialysis. That is still in the other bill. This provision is relating to the cancer treatment portion of the emergency medical assistance coverage.
Senator Higgins.
So even though the spreadsheet shows dialysis grants at zero, they're actually reflected in the big spreadsheet that we had last week in this committee, and that hasn't changed?
That's right.
Just to be sure, Mr.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, that's correct. The current bill that we had in the committee a week or so ago has not changed. That provision is still there. However, and I won't be offering that, we're calling it a technical amendment. In this committee, we do have an amendment on the floor that will extend that dialysis funding into the tails, which in our...
No, it does the opposite.
I'm sorry, does the opposite? Yeah. Does the opposite, the other way around. So there is going to be a slight modification of that provision in the technical amendment that we'll see on the floor. But the funding of the dialysis grants has not been deleted. This just shows what's the effect of this particular amendment.
So the effect of this Senator is now Higgins. We have both cancer and dialysis when we finally
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, that's correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Mr. Albright?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the result is that the cancer portion is still contingent on the money actually getting here.
From the HMOs?
Yes.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
I just wanted to be real clear on that.
Okay.
All of this is contingent, and if you look at the amendment, there's an effective date at the end that describes the conditions under which these appropriations would actually go into effect. So as Senator Hand indicated on the dialysis portion of this emergency medical assistance, when we get to the floor today, there will be an amendment that makes it basically look the same as this so that it doesn't have any tails. And then on Section 10 on page 16 of the amendment is a similar study to the PCA one, asking the commissioner to take a look at the emergency medical assistance program and come back to the legislature with a recommendation on how to serve that population in a more efficient and or effective way.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Hand,
to those points that Mr. Albrecht is making, both the PCA and the emergency medical assistance coverage, which because we're using one-time money, we're funding just for the current biennium. And I met with Commissioner Jessen yesterday, I believe, talking about these provisions, and it was her suggestion that we put the language in the bill that would ask the department to do some further work on how we can manage these things going into the future and not just, you know, fund them and just leave it open. I think they anticipate that there are things that they can do to try to make the program better, more effective. And I think many members know, particularly with the PCA program, there have been issues in the past about how that has worked and concerns. And we did have some major modifications made a couple of years ago. And I think Commissioner Jessen indicated a desire to have the department to continue to look at that. So that is one reason why we have not extended this into the tails, partly because of that discussion with the commissioner.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I've got a question back a little ways on the spreadsheet relative to the autism residential campus planning. you mentioned, you brought up this transfer to the Department of Education, and I'm trying to find any reference to that or where that is in the amendment, and I somehow am blinded.
It's at page 16.
And what it was to be used for, what their role was in this.
On the first page.
Madam Senator Chair Olson. And Senator Olson,
right in
it's on line 1.25.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So could
Senator
you clarify, Madam Chair and Senator Hand, could you clarify what that means for activities related to developing a plan for
Senator Hand?
What do you see their role as, or how does that fit into the overall proposal?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the money is a result of a fiscal note that was done on Senator Senjum's bill. And I think if you look on page 17 of the amendment, there is a section 12 that talks about what Senator Senjum's bill would require is that the Commissioner of Human Service, in consultation with the Commissioner of Education,
okay,
to develop a plan to create a residential campus providing 24-hour supervision for individuals' diagnosis of autism. And so in the course of the fiscal note, there was the and I don't recall the precise what the analysis or the assumptions that were made, but the fiscal note showed that cost going to the Department of Education.
Senator Olson?
I don't know that we had any chance to hear that particular bill, but the diagnostic code that would be the entree for participation in the residential treatment, is that, you know, there's autism has got a, the spectrum has got a quite a wide range of the disability. And earlier this year, I had some parents with autistic children come in, and they had been, it was remarkable what they had done with some early intervention and work where they had gotten some training to be able to work with their children. And in two of the cases, the children, when they entered school, were not being labeled, they were not having to go into special ed. They were able to cope with the situations that faced them, and because oftentimes it has nothing to do with their abilities and their ability to learn. It's more in their interactions and behaviors and speech and this type of thing. But is that, I just wondered if there was any differentiation in that diagnostic code for that. Obviously, if it's working toward a residential, it's not necessarily having as a component any focus on assistance for parents and some of the early intervention techniques. Was that the total focus was really on this residential, and is it for the higher end disability of the autism spectrum?
Yeah.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, according to the fiscal note from the Department of Education, the population is described as people with a diagnosis of autistic disorder with severe and profound needs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, my recollection from the testimony we heard from Senator Senjum and his witnesses and committee is that it was designed for individuals who probably would not be successfully kept in the home. And I think this is a planning process to see if there is another way we can be of help to these kids that have the profound diagnosis.
Mr. Alder, you want to continue, please?
Madam Chair and members, going on to line 117, this is also a governor's proposal that is not modified. The governor's proposal was for one-time money for essential community support services grants. And these grants are go along with a provision in our that we enacted last year that's also addressed in our other bill that you saw earlier relating to implementing what's called the nursing facility level of care changes. And these grants are used to help pay for expenses for people who are transitioning from nursing home care into the community. And this is anticipating the approval of the federal waiver to implement that early and therefore making some money available to assist those transitions earlier than we had anticipated previously. On line 129, this is Senator Hahn. Oh, I'm sorry, 121. A Senator Hahn provision that would repeal a fee-for-service. It's not an FFP rate reduction. It's a fee-for-service rate reduction that was enacted last year. It was enacted as a rate reduction for this biennium only. The reason that it shows tails is just because there's also a two-month payment delay for MA providers in the fee-for-service program. It's about a 3% rate reduction that was enacted, so this would just reverse it.
And Madam Chair, to that point, as you may recall, in the bill we had last year, we did try to work hard to avoid rate reductions since there had been a number of rate reductions in previous years, and we were trying to avoid those things, but in the course of trying to settle the budget differences, we found some that were unavoidable, and we thought we could take advantage of the funds to do that, even though this does have about $1.2 million in the tails.
Madam Chair and members, on line 126, this is a governor's proposal relating to corporate foster care. It delays by 1 year a provision that was enacted last year in order to allow a little more time to basically assess the implications of implementing the provisions that were enacted last year and to do some needs assessments and such. On line 133, this is a governor's proposal also that modifies a provision enacted last year that was a 10% rate reduction for congregate living, lower needs residents, and this changes that to a 5% reduction permanently ongoing.
Thank you. Are there questions about where the appropriations are going?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, did you give any consideration to doing even some partial restoration of the reductions to MRC for our teaching of health professionals, which I think is probably going to be an increased demand when we look at our, well, both from what I've personally experienced and what we see happening as people age.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, yes, we did. We were trying to, frankly, look at some of the things that we felt were providing direct care resources to people and wanted to give those priority. The discussion about the MRC funding, we don't have anything in our bill, in the base bill or in this amendment, but I have been in discussions with Representative Abler in the House, and they do have some placeholder and dollars in their bill, and it is going to be a topic of discussion. There are differences between our bill and the House bill, and so that provision will be, when we get to conference committee, a part of the discussion, but we do not have anything currently in our bill to address that, but we certainly did consider that.
So Madam
Senator
Chair
Olson
and Senator Hahn, so you may, you don't sound like you're opposed to accommodating some of that in the negotiations of the conference committee?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, no, I'm not opposed to it at all. I think, as you know, this is always a struggle to deal with
sure.
requests and needs that exceed the capacity of the resources we have. And we've tried to take the approach of in some way, trying to prioritize those things and focusing on what we can do to provide direct assistance to the extent possible, not diminishing at all the importance of what MRC can do, and there is a significant amount of interest in doing some things to restore that, at least partially. So, yes, we will be talking about that with the other body and the conference committee, and I'm certainly not taking the position that we're in opposition at all to the program, but it will be something that will work out in the conference process.
Thank you.
Members, I see on the spreadsheet that the House has $1 million, and here's a placeholder for MRC funding on the bigger spreadsheet. And it looks like the House spread their money around in littler amounts to a lot of things, and you've chosen to go and maybe almost completely fund some of the things. Is that the route you chose, Senator Hand?
Madam Chair, I think that's fair. Again, trying to particularly focus on things that we didn't really want to do in the budget that we had last year, but we, of course, in the course of settling that, we had to make some choices that none of us really welcomed, and trying to see what we could to restore those things to the best that we could.
Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Han, I particularly appreciate the restoration to the PCA reduction and would ask that as you negotiate in conference with the House that you hold very strong to that. That's probably the thing that I heard most from family members and from the broader community was their real strong need for that restoration. So I appreciate that. And I do have a follow-on, but did you want to comment on that first, Senator Hand?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, yes. The House bill, which we've looked at a little bit, had anticipated this contingent monies prior to their actually being announced. And they do have in their bill a some appropriations related to that. I'll be candid. I'm not sure if I fully understand what they're doing. We'll learn more when we get into the conference committee. But it is a significantly different approach than what we're taking in this bill. So I do know from talking to Representative Abler that the PCA program is important in the House. And so my anticipation is that this is a provision that we don't expect to yield on.
Good. And then, Madam Chair, Senator Han, I want to raise just an unrelated thing just for conversation. I don't have an amendment here today. I don't think Senator Roebling does, but we had discussed this. One of the things, you know, we have this new committee, the Reform and Redesign Committee, and we really just came out with one effort from this new committee. You know, we got started late and didn't have a chance to work that deeply, but the thing that we came out with, we all felt very strong about, and that was a benchmark study. And what that would entail is an opportunity to look at every single thing that we do in state government from a cost and efficiency perspective and relate it to how does that, where does that stand compared to the private sector as well as other states. And by doing that, what you would find at the end of that study is you could see where our costs were out of line. And that would give us a roadmap for how really to attack this issue of reform and redesign. Rather than just shooting an arrow here and hoping that one works out, we would really have a strategic map of how to move forward. And feel very strongly that is the next step. The governor's office worked with us on that. The administration, they believed in our bill. They supported our bill. It's less than $1 million to do this, you know, significantly less. That's all we need to get it done. And the relationship between that effort and this is quite strong because if you look at where our dollars are being spent, as you know, in terms of state dollars and where they're likely to be spent going into the future, I think it's very directly related to Health and Human Services. So I'm wondering if there was a provision, and maybe it'll be carried in some other way, I don't know, but if there was a provision that put that study in here, would that be something you were open to, or would you rather see it travel separately?
Senator
Hammond. Madam Chair, I guess my preference would be to have it travel separately. Certainly, I agree with the intent of what you're describing. And we do have provisions, as I indicated, in this contingent amendment to look at PCA and look at the emergency EMA that the department has told us that they would like to do that. In the bulk of in the base bill, we also have a provision that asks for a study on the part of the department, actually contracting with someone outside of the department to look at the whole managed care area from that very perspective. So we do have elements in the bill that may not be exactly what you're doing, but are aimed in that direction. And as I understand your bill itself, it has a little broader scope
than
just
broader.
Health and Human Services. So I guess I would be reluctant to take it into the bill, not having heard it in our committee, but I do want to point out that we do have provisions in the bill that I think are aiming at that very thing that you're mentioning.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Stump, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. I agree with Senator Hand on his last comment that the policy changes ought to be made in the committee there that are responsible for the policy. But apart from that, it seems like Well, a couple of reactions. The overall trend is kind of pretty clear that, you know, increased spending is going to be a part of the picture. With the additional services such as autism and it seems like dialysis and cancer treatment, things like that, would normally just have a trend upward. How does all of this kind of mesh with what you see or have envisioned going forward with healthcare changes? I mean, one reaction I had is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of preventative measures in here in terms of trying to we can reduce the, you know, a rate, let's say, from 10% to 5%, but that doesn't really address, I mean, that 10% might address the need, not 5%. But it seems like overall there ought to be a more emphasis on how do we get at the real source of the problem, which is maybe a different way of operating or to give you an example, like in education, and this I probably wasn't successful when I was chairing it either, but one thing I thought made sense to try to address the obesity was to zero in on the nutrition end of it and to emphasize the need for a higher quality, better, whole grain foods served in our schools and so on. How do we do this? Do something like that in healthcare as we go forward?
And Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, I certainly share your concern, and I think it's one of those problems that have been longstanding that we've faced for years. I don't think anybody has the answer to it. From my perspective, I think one of the things that we ought to try to work toward, and what I've heard from talking to numbers of providers, physicians, and others, that the real challenge is to get individuals to connect what they do and what happens in the future. You know, we all make decisions day to day on what we eat or our habits that we may form and how we live our lives. And it's difficult to sometimes connect the choices we make today with whatever may be sometime in the future. But that really is, I think, the heart of this problem. I believe that there is a need to reinforce that connection by doing things, for example, such as having our insurance structure reflect that when people are making good choices, they may see a reduction in their costs in terms of their premium, similar to when people drive cars and they do things to develop good driving habits and they follow the law and they don't speed and they don't, you know, do the things that would be likely to lead to problems, that people generally see a favorable treatment in their insurance premiums. I think there are things like that that I believe we should be trying to encourage to get people to make that connection between what they do today, the choices they make today, do have an effect in the future. And if you're making better choices, there can be a lower cost to individuals. Now, that may represent a philosophical divide that we may have, that I think that to me that suggests there has to be on the part of individuals a stronger connection to the cost of healthcare. And over the past number of years, I think there's been an effort to move away from that to suggest that those costs ought to be borne by state government or federal government, which, in my opinion, would serve to diminish that, making that connection. So I don't think that solves the issue that you're raising, but I do believe that we need to do some things to get people to understand better the choices that we make today do have long-term effects, and how do we get folks' attention to that and encourage them to make better choices. So I think there will be ongoing efforts. I know in the Department of Health, in talking to the commissioner and his staff, that is a an issue they're interested in. There have been grant dollars that have been set aside to address those things. I candidly have been somewhat of a skeptic of some of those things because I haven't seen that they have made the results of expending those monies clear, and we did have a provision in the bill last year to ask the Department of Health to try to do more to draw those connections to show that the monies that we're spending in preventive activities, for example, do have a positive effect. So I think it's going to be something that we'll just have to continue to work on.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, and I realize that I know time's short. I agree. I think there's different strategies. One would be incentives, which I think we've scattered all over the place, and some work and some don't. Another one would be kind of mandates where, you know, you try to put restrictions on things. And some of those work and some don't. Certainly haven't seen those work very effectively in the area of drug interdiction and stuff. But I think the one thing I absolutely agree with you is on individual responsibility. But you have this massive force on the other side. Basically commercialism, consumerism, whatever you want to call it, that has huge influence on our population, our communities. Like in our schools, the pop machines that funded parts of our programs over time tried to remove them. I mean, we had huge difficulties, but sugar has been had a huge negative impact on health of many individuals. So I guess we'll keep working on it.
And Madam Chair and Senator Stump, to that point, I no longer serve on the Agriculture Committee, but I'm not sure that there are people in the agriculture community that would necessarily agree with your comment about sugar. I think they may have some issue with that general characterization of the virtues or lack thereof of sugar. But I certainly agree that the mandates and the kinds of incentives we create do make a difference. And when we're talking about health care, we get into an area that I believe is we need to tread very carefully, because if we say, for example, that we believe that a certain thing is not healthy, and if we also agree that we're going to be paying substantial costs, then we as a legislature and other bodies may start to get into the business of saying, well, you may or you may not be permitted to do certain things that currently people are free to choose. And I think, in my opinion, we should tread carefully down that path. And I'm almost hesitant, Madam Chairman, to raise the point, but this does sound very reminiscent of a discussion we had in this committee a few days ago about gambling and about the advertising and the promotion of an activity that we may differ, but I certainly believe has deleterious effects on the society as a whole, and people differ about should that be something left up to individuals, or do we have a more broad social interest in the kinds of costs that attend to that. And I think that those kinds of arguments certainly attend to the debate on healthcare and how we deal with managing preventive issues going forward. So it is a debate that I think we're going to have for some time in the future.
Senator Hahn, I just wanted to ask you about the tails on the bill. On the larger spreadsheet, we're showing some pretty big tails. Can you address that, please?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, and we'll ask Senator Mr. Albrecht for some more explanation. But my understanding is that the bulk of the tails, I think it's somewhat over $30 million, is related to the part of the bill. Let's see if I can find the line here.
Madam Chair and members, it is $39 million that Senator Hahn is talking about, and it is related to the provisions on...
It's on line 199 in the bigger spreadsheet, the base spreadsheet, the continuing care rate reduction that is contingent upon the federal waiver being accepted. And we are showing in the tails what would be true if that waiver were not granted. And that's the $39 million cost. Now, everybody that I've talked to believes that that waiver will be granted. It's a timing issue, but we are trying to reflect in the bill itself that if that waiver is not granted, then certainly in the next budget cycle, we would need to wrestle with that issue and decide how to deal with it. But there is the expectation that that $39 million would fall off when the federal waiver was made good.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I'm looking at the wrong spreadsheet because your 199 is for disability grants, and I was been trying, like everything, to find where this House proposal is relative to the Merck Fund, and I can't find it. I'm just.
Madam Chair,
is it a different spreadsheet?
Senator Olson, I'm looking at the spreadsheet that was printed April 3rd. I don't know if that's in your packet or not. Maybe it isn't.
No.
Well, let me look at. I've got a
330.
I've got the one in that is in the packet. That would be on line 201.
Which is?
Of the large spreadsheet in your packet.
Is what?
The on lines 192 and 201 of the longer spreadsheet that's dated 330. At the bottom of the page,
yes,
and they deal with the 1.67 continuing care rate reduction, where, and that's what I was talking about.
That's the longest, largest expenditure.
That's where the $39 million entails is related to that item, and that is there because if the federal waiver does not get approved, then we would have in the next budget cycle to deal with that as a cost. Everybody that, as I said, I've talked to believes that we will receive the waiver, in which case that cost would fall off of the forecast.
Then Senator Olson, what we were talking about, the House proposal is not on this spreadsheet.
The Merck one was. For where I saw it.
Madam Chair, my belief is it is on there. Let me see if I can find it.
It's on 280 about, or 279.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Let's go.
Okay. Is there anyone here who wants to testify for or against? If not, Senator Hand, would you like to move the amendment first?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I would move adoption of the A-22 amendment to Senate file or House file 2294.
Probably should be changed.
And Madam Chair, I also. I'm sorry, we're doing the Senate file?
We are doing the Senate file.
And also we need to make an oral change. I'd like to incorporate into that motion. There's two, actually. One is on line 15.31 of your amendment, where we have a date. It says July 1st, 2014, and it should be July 1st, 2013. So change the 14 to 13 on line 1531. And the next is on page 6, line 6.5, which also has the date 2014, and that should also read 2013. So I'd like to incorporate into the motion those verbal changes in the amendment.
So Senator Hand moves the adoption of the A-22 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And that we weren't going to revisit the original bill, which we just did last Thursday. And so Senator Hand moves that Senate file 2093, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed back on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate file 2093 will be placed on general orders. And with that, members, we're about to adjourn. I just wanted to make an announcement. You might hear this today. Our wonderful fiscal analyst here has been hired by the University of Minnesota as the chief financial officer for the College of Liberal Arts.
Wow.
And no demonstrations. But we are